This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Dr. Andrew Lustig of Global Outreach Doctors. He's recently back from the border of Syria and Jordan, working in refugee camps there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we have you on sort of every time you come back from another disaster area, and it's reports from all over the world at this point. You are in one of the roughest areas of the world on this trip. How did you find yourself there? What did you see?
Well, as usual, we are interested in working in areas that are underserved. And we receive information or get contacted by various local agencies, governments, UNHCR, or other NGOs. And, you know, as we grow, we receive more inquiries for us to work elsewhere than us reaching out to these places. And in this particular case, we were asked by the president of a large NGO who had seen our work in Lesbos off the Turkey coast with refugees, and said, would you work with us on the Syria border? And so we put a team together, and we just returned a few weeks ago.
What is the nature of your team?
So we're a little different than other medical outreach and disaster response agencies, in that we have medical doctors and nurse practitioners, and but we also bring acupuncturists and naturopaths and alternative medical people. And in this particular trip, we had 11 team members, a mixture of medical doctors, about half and half, and acupuncturists. And then we expanded to about 25, because there were several medical doctors on the ground that were there independently that wanted to join us, as well as we picked up our translators and our drivers and all those people.
And so what did you do when you got there?
Well, we got a SIM card that works over there, so our phones work.
What is that? I mean, do you find yourself using your phone a lot? Does it become a tool of the work?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, when we work in disasters that have no electricity, you know, an earthquake or a typhoon, sometimes cell towers are working and sometimes they aren't. But, you know, in this particular case, we're working in a refugee camp that's established. It's a static population. We certainly need to communicate with the outside world, people back in the States, other doctors coming, doctors within the region we're working, and medical providers, logistics, and so on. So naturally, if we're not using satellite radios in places that don't have cell service, we're using our phones.
So, okay, so you had reception, and there you are in a refugee camp of, what did you say, 100,000 people?
Correct, yeah.
And so how do you set up? What happens?
So initially, whenever we deploy, I will tell you it's chaotic. You know, we don't sort of step into some very well-oiled situation where we just start sitting down and practicing medicine. You know, we have some great medical doctors, and they're organized, but where we work is generally not organized. Even the best-run clinical situations in developing countries or on the border of, you know, war zones and so on, it's chaotic. And so people are pulling at you, and people want medical services, and they're speaking in different languages, and you have sometimes more than one language, so you need different types of interpreters. And you try to organize the patient flow. And, you know, there's hundreds of people, and some of them are patients, some of them are relatives of patients. You have to identify which ones are the patients. Some of them are obvious. You can see they're sick. Get a triage system going, so you're taking care of the most serious people first, and then starting to triage those patients to specialties, you know, pediatrics, neonatal, adult, elderly, and so on.
So You were seeing people who had been at this refugee camp for a while, or were there also fresh refugees coming in?
So we've seen both refugees that have been in this camp for quite a long time have chronic issues or may have picked up a few acute issues because they're living in a small city of tents and, unsanitary conditions and electricity that's intermittent, no running water. And so they will have certain chronic issues and certain acute issues that come up with any population in a refugee camp. And then we're also seeing refugees that have recently arrived. So it's a combination of both.
So tell us about some of the people you met and some of the stories you witnessed and heard.
Well, first and foremost, we're talking about more than 50% of the refugee camps being occupied by children. And a majority of the rest, women, and then some men. And, I've been asked, well, why are there just some men? And many of the men haven't made it because they are, of fighting age and they just haven't made it across. But also, true in America and true around the world is women are the ones that seek medical attention before men, and men tend to wait until it's critical or until they die. Everybody has a story. These refugees, these Syrian refugees, are not the same refugees necessarily that we saw in Lesbos that were coming across in boats from Turkey. Those refugees were Syrian, Iraqi, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and those refugees are fleeing, equally difficult conditions. But this population is almost entirely Syrian, and every one of them have seen or witnessed or been part of, atrocities that are unbelievable. And so we provide mental health treatments through acupuncture, so their physical trauma is not the only thing that we're treating. And in any physical trauma, you also kind of want to know what's going on in their mind and their heart. And the stories are horrific.
Do you remember any of them that you are willing to tell us?
Sure. You will meet children that are missing limbs. And invariably, I think it's fortunate that they will say something like this, like a young boy of 10 years old named Bashar from Syria, who was actually in a rehab center, missing both legs in a wheelchair and missing half of one arm. And through a translator told me, I was playing outside near my home in Syria. I bent down to pick up a box and I woke up in a hospital without legs. And Bashar's story is interesting because it's not unique, but it's just one of these things that, he's very angry. All of his siblings are in Syria. His mother's in Syria. His father's been killed. He's been without his family for a very long time, and he has sort of a level of anger, and it's depends when you talk to him whether he's even willing to talk to you or not. I think when we spoke with him and we treated him with acupuncture to try to help his both his fear and his anger, afterwards he and I played foosball because there was a little foosball set up, and believe it or not, he has Facebook. We're Facebook friends. And that's just one story. And there was another man I met who actually was a doctor in Syria and actually was practicing medicine on the Syrian border with us. And, on a break, I noticed he was smoking, and I said, you're smoking. It's not good for you. And he said, well, I picked it up in prison. I said, prison? He said, yes, I about 8 years ago, and was speaking out against some issue in Syria, and I found myself arrested and in prison, and I was put in a prison for the first 2 years. That's one of the worst prisons in Syria. They pull people's nails out. He was later transferred to another prison and now is helping his Syrian friends as a doctor. And it's rich, it's poor, it's children, it's elderly, every walk of life. And what's amazing is even people with means, you know, that money doesn't buy them anything other than the very expensive transport from wherever they're coming, Aleppo or wherever, to the border, you know, by some coyote who's got basically a cattle car that he's loaded 100 people in. He gets halfway. And this is some of the stories I've heard as well, is, you know, what was your journey like? You know, well, I was in a cattle car with 100 people. It was really long. We were there for 10, 20 hours. You know, we were urinating in this car. We were not let out. We didn't have any food. And they stop shy of the border and they ask everybody for more money. And, you know, some of these people are at gunpoint, and it's just, it's actually Syrians preying on Syrians, because these are, you know, people that are going to figure out how to make money on this. So, lots of bad stories.
So those people, some of them end up in a refugee camp. What happens, for example, to the ones who are in the cattle car who don't come up with any more money? They're just let out in the middle of the desert?
You know, the journey is pretty traumatic, potentially as traumatic to some degree as where they're fleeing from. And those that make it across, make it across. And those that don't, I don't have contact with them. You know, potentially a fair amount that don't make it are captured or killed, or return back home. And, you know, I shared with you the documentary by those awesome people, Frontline, just amazing, amazing work over so many decades.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a chance, go to pbs.org and look for the Frontline documentary about a family with four Syrian children. I think it's very important for people to see this. I think it's important for Americans to see it and just know the actual faces of what people are living through.
Yeah, that documentary was called The Children of Syria. You can Google it on Frontline. And the reason, you know, I'm mentioning that is because it's a really a first-hand approach, first view approach for the last 3 years of what it's like to be a family and children fleeing Aleppo. You know, we met these people, fortunately, who have made it across. We are not meeting the people in Syria. It's not a problem for Global Outreach Doctors to get into Syria. It's a problem for us to get out. And so that's why we were working on the Jordanian border, just 5 miles from the Syrian border.
When you say it's a problem to get out, what do you mean?
Invariably, whoever you were helping in Syria, you're on the wrong side. There's just so many factions. There are just so many areas that that are either under ISIS control, or you know, and so it's just impossible to help one group without another group being interested in taking you out. So it's just hard to get back out of Syria.
So, how long were you there?
So our usual deployments are just a few weeks, and then we try to rotate through other medical professionals when we return. We were there just a few weeks. We made some substantial contacts with various medical facilities. You know, in the future, when we're well funded, we will bring our own medical facility. You know, there are portable medical hospitals that come in 20 Pelican cases. Unfortunately, they're about $500,000, and we don't have that at the moment. We,
Pelican.
Pelican cases, those are, you know, watertight cases that are used to transport goods. We've made substantial contacts in the region, and we continue to stay in touch with them and look at ways that we can deploy additional doctors and nurse practitioners and acupuncturists. And in fact, there is a rehab facility called Syriot, which means female woman, and it's started by three women from Syria who basically take in children that are missing limbs and take in boys and try to offer physical therapy. And so we're working with them to provide acupuncture and physical therapist.
What kind of permanent medical presence is in these refugee camps? Somebody, or refugee cities, whatever you call it, somebody like your group might rotate in for a while. What happens when you leave?
So in a refugee camp like Zaatari, which is 100,000 people, It's been there for a few years. This is where refugees end up and are detained. There are barbed wire fences around the entire perimeter of this 100,000 person camp.
To
there
keep
are
people
keep
out
people
or
keep
in?
both. So we work through the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and the credentialing is difficult. It takes a while, and when you clear, you are allowed to enter into this camp and provide medicine. The camp is guarded by tanks. At one point, when we had a little time off, I was playing soccer with some of the boys, and you're not allowed to photograph the military that guard the camp. But we had pictures of playing soccer with these children, and just beyond the soccer, I would call it a field, a big dirt area, were tanks. And just watching us play soccer is kind of an eerie, weird situation. But the military are there, and this is the Jordanian military, to keep refugees contained to one area. Some of the refugees are allowed to leave, but they're not allowed to leave with their entire family, and they're tracked, and they have to return. And of course, if their family's there, that keeps them returning. But there, it's a very, very difficult logistical nightmare for any refugee to leave that Zaatari camp and go into, say, other parts of Jordan. There are other smaller refugee camps where other refugees are contained, or if they're not being held, they're under even worse conditions than Zaatari, which is, you know, staffed by UNHCR, USAID, Doctors Without Borders, and several other NGOs, and the Jordanian Health Ministry has facilities there, as well as operations from Italy. I mean, we had meetings with NGOs that had medical facilities that were from Spain, one from Saudi Arabia, and we basically introduce ourselves, tell them what we're doing, offer services that they don't offer, particularly kind of in the area of trauma and acupuncture, because there are a lot of medical doctors there. And so when we rotate out, other groups come in, and there are some permanent installations where there is always a provider. But the problem is it's a numbers game. I mean, you're talking about 80 to 100,000 people that need medical care from a few, you know, NGOs that have, you know, a couple of doctors in each of their medical tents.
Now, when you think about what that means, I'm thinking about Santa Fe, which is fewer than 100,000 people, and there's doctor's offices all over the place. There's a whole huge hospital. There's emergency clinics. I don't know what the numbers are, but it's like a great medical complex compared to what you're seeing there for the same number of people, many of whom are much more in crisis than most of us.
You know, the situation in parts of the developing world, in Africa, for instance, is there is one doctor for 20,000 patients, not in all parts of Africa, in some parts of Africa. And the numbers, of course, in developed worlds are much higher. And I don't actually know the numbers here and in Canada and place in Europe and so on. But what it means, unfortunately, is you try to give the best attention to each patient. And we've got some great doctors from different parts of the world, from the UK, from Canada, from US. We were working with some Jordanian doctors that joined our team. And you try to give each patient individual care. But it's also a number game because you've got hundreds and hundreds of patients. We treated between 400 or 500 patients a day with our team of 11. And, you know, you may be treating multiple patients at once. And then our partner organization treated another 400 or 500. And these were over maybe 5 or 6 different locations, not all in one location. So our doctors were spread out in different refugee camps, all probably within about an hour from the border of Syria. And but it's a numbers game.
Do you find the, let's say, Syrian equivalent of curanderos sort of springing up in camps like this?
It's interesting. You know, Zaatari is this camp that sort of started out small and just completely outgrew itself, and over the 3 years is, you know, well exceeding the size camp that it was supposed to be. And so what happens is you have, you know, Syrians that were barbers or mechanics or bakers, and they just put their chair out in the middle of the street and start cutting hair. I mean, there are people that were bakers and they start baking, you know, breads. And so there is a an existing sort of both social and commercial infrastructure there. I mean, albeit that it's in tents and tin shacks and, you know, situations like that. And the same thing with, you know, natural medical providers. Of course, if they're a medical doctor, they would have to be licensed to work in Jordan. But certainly there are sort of, as you say, curanderos, those practicing sort of household medicine.
So you did your work there, came back. How do you and how do the other doctors and practitioners take care of themselves and recover from what you've witnessed? Because there's always that kind of secondary trauma.
Right. Well, we treat ourselves with our own medicine, so trauma acupuncture for PTSD is a very potent solution. You know, we've all been doing this for a while, and I guess we have our various coping mechanisms. Sometimes it doesn't hit you for a few weeks. You're on a bit of adrenaline, and so you're not really feeling. I mean, certainly there were times when we definitely cried while we were there, just, you know, horrific stories or children or whatever. And but, you know, there is sort of that decompression. You get home and, you know, after 2-3 weeks, it starts to hit you what, you know, you've seen and witnessed. And then you're still inundated with, you know, more and more information because I personally and several of our doctors sort of surround ourselves every day with contacts discussions, continued discussions, either by phone or Skype or social media with, doctors that are working there and so on.
What's next for you?
So we were contacted almost a few days after we returned by some local officials and an NGO in northern Iraq, in the Kurdistan region of northern Iraq. And there's 2 million Kurdish refugees in this Duhok region. And the Duhok region, you fly into the Erbil Airport, Erbil. It's an international airport. You need to access the Duhok region by going around Mosul, which is ISIS-controlled territory. And you sort of circle around to the east and then north to get to Duhok. And we're assembling a team, and I think it's possible we may work there in the next 6 to 8 weeks and help the Kurds with their crisis there.
What's going on there?
Well, you have, the conflict that's been going on for quite some time in Iraq, and the Kurds have been sort of pushed out, and there are various forces like in many places, it's a complex group of people that are fighting, mostly on a religious basis. There are both Arabs and Kurds in the Kurdistan region. And in fact, I will tell you that they don't all get equal treatment, depending on who's doing the treating. There are doctors that won't treat Arabs, and there are doctors that won't treat Kurds. But the Kurdistan region is, you know, it's within Iraq, but it's almost like a separate country. I mean, the border is similar to some degree, like the border between Jordan and Syria. So while we will have, you know, security, and it is sort of not the same as working in Baghdad and southern Iraq and central Iraq, which are, you know, frontline, highly dangerous areas. You know, you are in a situation in Duhok, where, the enemy, ISIS, is, 45 minutes away from where you're working. And in fact, very unfortunately, there was, as people have maybe seen on the news, a Navy SEAL killed yesterday or the day before because the Kurdistan Army's border was broken through by ISIS, and they were able, with 100 ISIS fighters, to get to a Navy SEAL and take him out. And so, you know, this is a little bit worrying for us, knowing that that border, that Kurdistan region, which hasn't been porous for quite some time, there was a breach. We're sort of getting our various security reports, and I'm on the phone with various people in Iraq to sort of understand, you know, the best, safest way to work there. And then, of course, the best specialties to bring. What is not being offered? Because Global Outreach Doctors doesn't want to just help with capacity. That is often needed, and we'll do that. But we really want to know, what specialties do we need to bring? You know, we found that in the Syrian border, there weren't enough pediatric providers. So we brought a lot of pediatric providers, and we're sort of getting that information now, you know, both on a security level, but also on a specialty level. Which surgeons do we need? Do we need surgeons? What specialties do we need?
What is your hope for Global Outreach Doctors in the years to come?
My hope is it gets more and more difficult for me as one person and our volunteers to navigate the number of missions that we are doing and be the fundraisers, the social media, the PR, the logistics. We have got some great volunteers. We're all volunteers. But what we really need is regular paid staff, so that when we go away, there's a group here that are sort of maintaining the fort. When I'm overseas, I'm still trying to handle the phone calls and the logistics in the U.S. The time zone is different. The amount of workload is just tremendous. So my hope is that as we build our team to about 250 medical providers worldwide, that we have the administrative support beyond my two hands and a few of the other volunteers.
Andrew Lustig is the founder and director of Global Outreach Doctors, which is on the web at globaloutreachdoctors.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.